Thank you very much, Tanya, for your generous introduction. And for quoting something moderately intelligent I may have said once. I want to thank all of you for coming along today in support of the Unika Foundation. This is the sixth occasion at which people have come and paid an exorbitant sum for a nice lunch and 25 minutes of chat from me in support of this very worthy cause. One of the things I learned, actually, as being part of the foundation, is that depression is actually a lot more widespread than I knew it was. And most of us here, I suspect, of someone close to us has been touched by it. And if that hasn't happened, it probably will at some point. So it's a serious problem, and I thank you very much for your support of the foundation. I want to thank as well, in particular, Macquarie Bank, who donates the venue and the food for today, as they do each year, and to the Australian Business Economists, whose very considerable logistical support lets us operate this function much more efficiently and effectively than we could otherwise. So, Tanya and your colleagues at Macquarie, and Steve Halmarik and the ABE executive, I thank you very much, both of you, for that support. In last year's address, I talked about fiscal difficulties being faced by governments of some of the world's largest countries in the wake of the financial crisis. A theme of that talk was that a number of advanced economies were facing, or had been facing for a while, the need to address long-term structural issues, and those issues really arise from the inevitable collision between demographics and entitlements. But a deep recession and a slow recovery and the effects of that on revenues had brought forward the pressure to face those issues. Well, over the past year, we've seen the focus on fiscal sustainability continue to increase. The problems, of course, have been most acute in Greece, though unfortunately not confined to that country. Greece is a small country, very small, but it's assumed a certain, symbolic significance in this debate. The citizens of Greece are now experiencing an austerity regime of historic proportions. And that's a precondition of getting access to official funding that will help them to meet their near-term obligations. But the longer-term solution surely is going to involve the taxpayers of Europe more broadly accepting part of the cost of restoring Greece to sustainability. And the recent agreement just over the weekend appears to me, at least, to be a further step in that direction, as it shifts risk out of the private balance sheets and effectively onto the balance sheets of the European public sector. I would view that as a step on the road to an eventual solution, though I think the policymakers of Europe continue to face a very delicate task in preserving fiscal sustainability and the single currency at the same time. Concerns about the US fiscal position have also increased now that Europe has calmed down a little bit, though that hasn't been reflected, at least as yet, in the pricing in the markets of US debt. The immediate need, of course, is for the US authorities to lift the debt ceiling and then for them to work toward longer-term sustainability. In both the European and the US cases, the process of allowing things to go right to the brink of an extremely disruptive event before an agreement is reached on how to move forward has been a source of great uncertainty and anxiety right around the world. And that anxiety has extended to Australia, even though, as I'm sure you're all sick of hearing me say, we are living through a once-in-a-hundred or more year event in our terms of trade. I'm not going to recite the facts yet again. Suffice to say that this is at least potentially the biggest gift the global economy has handed to Australia since at least the gold rush of the 1850s. Yet it seems at the moment we're all pretty much unhappy about that. Measures of confidence are down, and there's an evident sense of caution among households and businesses, which I would say seems to have become more intense over the past few months. There are, I suppose, a number of factors to which we could appeal to offer an explanation of that. The natural disasters in the summer clearly had some impact on confidence. Interest rates, or intense speculation about what they may or may not do, is said by some to have had an impact on confidence, even though we've just had a period of more than a year in which the cash rate changed only once, which is the most stable outcome for 5 years. Increasingly bitter political debates over various issues are also said by some to have played a role in affecting confidence. Then we have the global outlook, which looks darker for the reasons I was just talking about. So that maybe has played a role. We could note, on the other hand, that the Chinese slowdown, which we've all been looking for, is at least at this point a relatively mild one, I would say. And that's good, but then mention of China these days reminds people that the emergence of China and other countries in Asia is changing the shape of the world economy, and it's changing the shape of our economy, and that means structural change. Structural change is something that none of us find comfortable in the short term, even though a capacity to adapt to structural change is a hallmark of all of the most successful economies. So the description of consumers as cautious has become commonplace, and it's hard to disagree with that. In fact, I think it might have been the Reserve Bank that started to inject that term into the lexicon a couple of years ago. I don't wish in any way to dismiss the genuine concerns that many people have. I think all of us are trying to make sense of the disparate information that's coming toward us from all sides. What I want to suggest is that in order to make sense of all of this, at least in terms of the household caution, it's worth taking a longer term perspective and looking back away, and so that's what I want to do today. And I have two pictures that I think might help us to understand the story. I'm not going to do what I did the last time I showed a chart in a public speech, was to try to guess people to get people to guess which series it was without the labels. I'll just go straight to the labels. So here we have real household disposable income. It's measured, this is the level, is measured in per capita terms. That's probably not how we often see it, but I think for this purpose it's a useful way to do it. It's shown on a log scale, so you can get some sense of change in trend from the slope of the line. We've also got here real per capita household consumption, measured the same way out of the quarterly national income accounts. What I'm doing here is then I'm going to put two trend lines through those to show you the trend rate of growth between 1995 and 2005. A couple of interesting things to note here. One is that the trend growth of income, 2% per year per capita, that's actually a pretty respectable pace of growth of income for an advanced economy. It's more than double the growth rate seen in the preceding 20 years in Australia. Think about that, 2% a year using the rule of 35. That means per capita income growth, per capita income doubles every 35 years. So in the time I've been working as an economist, the average per capita income in the country would have doubled had it grown at that rate for that time. Notice also that the trend rate of growth of consumption, which is 2.8% a year, it's a steeper line. So these two lines were on their way to meeting. 2.8% was a full percentage point higher than the growth rate seen in the preceding 10-year period, and quite similar actually to the strong per capita consumption growth seen in the late 60s and early 70s. So for 10 years, up to 2005, growth in consumption exceeded growth in income by about 0.75 percentage point on average each year. In fact, that's a 20-year trend. Consumption growth had been exceeding income growth in the preceding 10 years as well. And then at the bottom, the simple arithmetic between the two lines, the saving rate. This is the gross saving rate, so it's not the net one used in the published accounts. It hasn't had depreciation deducted, but it's done that way to make it simpler to relate it to the two lines at the top. So saving fell continually. In fact, that was pretty much a 20-year trend of declining saving rates as well. So that's up to 2005. As you can see, things began to change after that. From about 2006, real per capita income sped up. Over the 5 years to the end of 2010, it grew at 2.9% a year, so nearly a percentage point faster than it had been growing. It's probably not entirely coincidental that that's the period when the terms of trade really began to rise in earnest. But while all that was happening, from about 2007, consumption growth slowed down. In per capita terms, real consumption today is about the same as it was 3 years ago. If you think about that, no per capita growth in spending for 3 years, it's no wonder that people are talking about consumer caution. It's no wonder that retailers find this very tough indeed. Coming after a period where real per capita spending had been rising by 2.8% a year for 10 years, no net growth over 3 years is quite a change. But these figures say that it's not lack of income growth that explains that. It isn't, at least on these published data, that the income isn't there. It's that people are choosing, for whatever reason, not to spend it in the way that they had been doing in the preceding 10 years. So why is that, really, is the question. Well, here it's time to introduce the second chart. This is measured the same way over the same period, and it's real household assets. It includes financial assets, the bulk of which is super, and it includes non-financial assets, which of course is mostly housing. There's also some trend lines shown here, measured over the same period from 95 to 05. A couple of quick snapshots. The average gross assets across Australian households, according to these data, is about $800,000 per household at the moment, or about $300,000 per person. There's about 2.5 people on average in each household. From 1995 to 2005, assets rose at an annual average pace of 6.7% in real per capita terms. We can't quite do these figures way back in a comparable way, but we can use the Treasury series on net worth going right back to 1960. And from 1960 to 1995, the average per capita real growth rate of that series was about 2.5%. That is roughly in line with per capita GDP, which is what you'd expect. So the growth from 95 to 05 was well over double the long-run rate of growth of wealth or assets. A significant part of that additional growth was in the value of dwellings. The extent of leverage also rose, as you can see in the bottom panel, to about 17% at the end of 2005, and it's gone up a little more since then. So a question worth contemplating really is, had we really found a powerful and hitherto unknown route to genuine wealth, or was this period from 1995 to 2005 unusual? Well, looking back, it seems now that it was unusual. In 2008, as everyone knows very well, the trend changed. Real assets per person declined for a while during the crisis, and given the nature of that crisis, that isn't surprising. They've since risen again, but they certainly haven't regained that earlier trend, and they show no sign at this point in doing so. That is an adjustment that's less dramatic than one could find, I'm sure, in other countries. Nonetheless, it is a very substantial change in trend. If people had been banking on a continuation of that earlier trend, then they'd be pretty disappointed by now. Of course, if that earlier trend had owed a good deal to borrowing money to hold assets, then a continuation of that trend would probably have exposed households to increasing risk as time went by. Well, casual observation, you can see where I'm going here, is that this change in trend in the growth of assets or wealth roughly coincided with the slowing in consumption spending relative to its earlier trend and certainly relative to the trend in income. It seems pretty clear to this particular armchair economist anyway that changes in consumption behaviour and changes in the saving and spending and borrowing behaviour of households have been connected. So I'd argue that the broad story here is roughly as follows. The period from the early 1990s to the mid-2000s was characterised by a drawn-out but one-time adjustment to a set of powerful forces. Households started that period with quite small amounts of leverage. That's in large part was a legacy of the effect of very high nominal interest rates through the long period of high inflation. But then, inflation and interest rates came down to generational lows. Meanwhile, financial liberalisation and innovation increased the availability of credit. Pretty stable economic conditions, part of the so-called Great Moderation internationally, made a certain degree of higher leverage seem safe. And the result of all that was a lengthy period of rising household leverage, rising house prices, high levels of confidence, a strong sense of generally rising prosperity, declining saving from current income, and strong growth in consumption. Now, I was not among those who felt that this trend was bound to end in tears, but it was bound to end at some point. Even if one holds a benign view of higher household debt, at a certain point, people will have reached a new equilibrium in which their leverage is now at its new higher level, or if you're a pessimist, maybe they've gone beyond that level. And at that stage, debt growth is going to slow down to be more in line with income. The rate of saving from current income is going to rise to be more like historical norms. And the financial source of upward pressure on housing values is likely to abate. There may well be other factors pushing up housing values, but that particular financial source is probably going to abate. Well, you can never predict with any confidence at all when that moment is going to come where households begin to change course. You can't predict what sequence of events might cause that. But if you thought about an international financial crisis that envelops several major countries, that has excessive borrowing by households at its heart, and which is coupled with a major change in the global availability of credit, well, that's a sequence of events which you would think is pretty likely, if nothing else was, to prompt a reassessment by households of the earlier trends. It would also prompt a re-evaluation by lenders of lending standards. And that is, I think, precisely what we've seen over the past 3 or 4 years. Well, what then are the implications of these changes? An important one, as I said at a previous Anika Foundation lunch 2 years ago, is that the role of the household sector in driving demand forward in the future upswing won't be the same as it was in the preceding period. The current economic expansion is, as we all know, characterised by a very large build-up and investment in the resource sector, some expansionary flow-on of that to some, but not all, other sectors of the economy, and so on. It certainly isn't characterised by very strong growth in areas like household consumption that had featured so prominently in the preceding period. Well, that's partly because the change in the terms of trade, which is, of course, a change in relative prices, that itself is going to occasion structural change in the economy. Some sectors are going to grow faster, others slower. And that's particularly the case if the starting point was one where there was not large-scale spare capacity in the economy. But those pressures for structural change are also coinciding with changes in household behaviour that's associated with these longer-run financial cycles that I've just been talking about. Just as some sectors are having to cope with the effects of relative price shifts, some sectors are also seeing the impacts of this shift in household behaviour towards more conservatism after a long period of very confident behaviour. While it would be quite reasonable to argue that this is all a lot to cope with all at once, it's difficult for the economy and for the various actors in it to cope with these changes all simultaneously, not to mention all the other things that people have to worry about right now. But if you think about how things might otherwise have unfolded, if you think about households undergoing this shift towards higher saving without the big rise in income that the terms of trade is providing, well, I think it's pretty clear that this would have been and would now be a considerably more difficult period of adjustment than we in fact face. So what then about the future? Can we look forward to a time in which household saving and balance sheets have been readjusted to normal and consumption could grow faster? Well, I think we can look forward to that. If I return to the first chart, the current divergent trends in those two lines aren't going to be any more sustainable than the previous converging trend was. At some point, I'd imagine these two lines will go more in parallel. The saving rate, debt burdens and assets and wealth and so on will reach levels at which people are more comfortable, and consumption will probably grow more in line with income, with a relatively steady saving rate. And at that point, we could reasonably expect to see consumption record more growth than it has in the past couple of years. After all, it's very unusual indeed for real per capita consumption not to grow for any length of time. We can't really know, of course, when that will occur. No doubt it will depend on what else is happening as well. We can note that the rise in the saving rate over the past 5 years has been much faster than its fall was in the preceding decade. In fact, it's as measured in this time series, this is the whole history of the quarterly saving rate data. And I should enter here the caveat that this is measured very imprecisely. It's subject to very large revisions, so there's some risk in building a very strong hypothesis here. But at least as measured, it's the biggest rise over that period that we've seen in that period, in that that history of 50 years. So the adjustment to what should be a more sustainable relationship between saving and income and spending is in fact proceeding pretty quickly. That's probably why it's become such a talking point, actually. And that in turn means that the time when more normal, quote-unquote, patterns of consumption recur is closer than it would have been with a more drawn-out investment adjustment. In fact, if you put this in long-run perspective and thinking back to the terms of trade episode, it's not at all unreasonable, it's probably sensible, for a nation which has suddenly had a sudden rise in national income conferred via the terms of trade to save a fair bit of it until it becomes clear how persistent the higher level of income is going to be. And as we get a better sense of that, maybe people will be a little more confident to spend some of that higher income. It's entirely possible, it seems to me, that were some of the current raft of uncertainties to lift at some point, the mood could change quite noticeably, in fact. So I don't think we should be totally gloomy about the prospects for the consumer. I suppose, though, the question is, what should we think of as normal behaviour? And in particular, are the good old days of consumption from 1995 to 2005 going to recur? Well, I don't think they can, at least not if the growth depends on spending growth outpacing income growth continually and leverage continually increasing over a long period. Certainly the rapidly rising saving rate we've seen in recent years isn't normal, but neither is a continually declining one. While the rise in the saving rate has been unusually rapid, the level that we see here, to the extent you can get any sense of normality out of the chart, this level at least looks a lot more normal than the very low one we saw 5 or 6 years ago. So a return to those earlier strong patterns of growth in consumption would instead require, and could really only sustainably be based on, a continuation of the faster pace of income growth that we've seen since about 2006. Just to go back to that. To the extent that that accelerated income growth has been a result of the increase in the terms of trade, however, it probably isn't going to continue at that same pace. On this chart, the level of income will probably stay high unless the terms of trade collapse, but the slope won't stay as strong as it's been in the last few years, because at least on our reckoning, the terms of trade are now probably at their peak. So if we want to sustain the rate of growth of incomes and hence lay a basis for a return to unusually strong growth in consumption that we saw in the golden period from 1995 to 2005, we have to look somewhere else to get that income. Now, all of you here know that ultimately there's really only one source of sustainably higher growth in incomes, and that's sustainably higher growth in productivity. Everyone here probably also, I think, knows by now that when you look at the data, it's pretty much impossible now to avoid the conclusion that productivity growth since the mid-2000s at least has been quite poor. So everything comes back actually to productivity, and actually it always does in a sense when we're talking about living standards and how much we can afford to consume. It's been observed in the past that periods of apparently easy affluence conferred by favourable international conditions might have lessened the sharpness of our focus on lifting productivity. Conversely, I think it could be argued that the will and the pressure for supply-side reforms that lift productivity was most acute when the terms of trade reached a long-term low in the mid-1980s. And those reforms, as we know, ushered in a period of strong productivity growth. The thing that Australia has rarely done, but which, if we could manage it, would really capitalise on our recent good fortune, would be to lift productivity performance while the terms of trade are high. The income result of that, if we could do it, would over time provide the most secure base for strong increases in living standards. And that sort of environment would be one in which the cautious consumer might feel inclined towards well-based optimism about the future and reopen those purse strings. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for your attendance and your attention, and I'll make an attempt at a few questions. Thanks very much.
Michael Stutchbury from The Australian. A paying customer.
Thank you, Michael.
Quickly digesting what you've had to say here at lunch might be that perhaps some of the business groups that are calling for the Reserve Bank to recognise that times are very tough, particularly in retail land, and maybe the central bank needs to give them a bit more of a break, but you're pointing out that we're really seeing more of a structural adjustment in consumer behaviour. Are you saying then, when you get to your end point about productivity growth, that the focus of business groups feeling that sort of crunch should be more on urging policymakers to get back to the sort of a reform policy reform agenda that we have seen previous decades? And if so, what would you see as the perhaps most profitable areas that policy should be getting into or addressing if we did really want to seriously revive our productivity growth?
Well, far be it from me to give advice to business groups on what they should say or do. My point about the household sector is, the point of the speech is, there are some pretty big long-run forces that have been at work. They're to do with the financial side of the economy. No doubt short-term things impinge on that as well, but we've been undergoing some pretty significant and far-reaching adjustments here in recent years, and I think we can make more sense of that and think about our prospects for the future more accurately and probably more optimistically, actually, if we recognise those trends. In a sense, there's two parts of the message here. One is that if you look at these long-run trends, well, it was always fairly likely, I guess, in hindsight, that we were going to see a period of much more subdued growth for a while in consumption. But actually, that adjustment has proceeded quite a long way already. And that's actually a point of optimism for the future, though I can't pretend it's, you know, blue sky optimism for the very near future, but we're actually building resilience into the balance sheets of our households pretty smartly right now, and I think that's a thing which will stand us in good stead, particularly if there are, you know, troubled times at some point in the future. In terms of productivity, I think it's probably not wise for me to list a whole bunch of detailed things, but we know that the overall thrust of the things which produced productivity in the past were sensible labour market regulation, competitive product market regulation. There's a whole host of things on the COAG type agenda in terms of efficiencies across the country, and I think also care in a number of other areas where we impose various standards that are a kind of, I guess you could call them OH&S, governance, these kind of things, they're all important and well-meaning, but we need to do all those things in a way that doesn't unduly add to costs. There's a whole bunch of things in there, and I'm sure the business groups could articulate them more effectively and in more detail than me. I think that's probably as good as I can do on that one today.
Sure. Subhash Pillay, thank you very much, Governor Stevens, for your comments today, especially picking such a topical subject. My question is related to the consumer, and, you know, you've taken us through the impact of rising per capita post-tax disposable income during the first phase of this investment boom. And my question to you is, as we look forward into the next phase of this investment boom, through what transmission mechanisms do you see the consumer benefiting, especially things which, if I look at the first part, a lot of that surplus was redistributed to the consumer via lower taxes and higher government outlays? Well, and the last bit, my apologies, is how does that weigh up against the potentially higher interest rates that consumers face as a consequence of the investment boom?
Well, you're right that for many years there were taxes going down, which largely offset the fiscal drag that the economy was producing under strong conditions. And one noticeable difference this year, of course, is that taxes have temporarily risen to pay for the Queensland floods. That's only temporary. But into the future, I suppose my story is that the parts of the economy that are going to be leading the charge in a demand sense, if you like, it's business sector investment, especially in resources and things like that, and a certain amount of public investment in infrastructure as well, which we clearly need. And the income from the mining sector, as I've said on other occasions, finds its way around the community through numerous channels. One of the key channels that I think in recent times has delivered effectively higher real income to the consumer is that the exchange rate's quite high and our purchasing power over foreign goods and services has gone up a lot. And, you know, we talk about consumer caution, and rightly so, but actually quite large numbers of us are not so cautious that we won't get on a plane and travel overseas and consume some vacation services that way. So there are numerous channels through which these income effects come the way of the household, even though some of them are indirect and not necessarily immediately obvious.
Governor Adam Donaldson from the Commonwealth Bank. My question follows that to an extent, and I guess it relates to the fact that you've presented quite a positive picture of household finances, or at least income. My question is around the dispersion of that income and whether perhaps that's unusually wide, and whether you're seeing signs of stress in the economy that might lead you to slightly different conclusions about the outlook for consumption. In particular, I guess I'm thinking of a chart that the Reserve Bank itself produces, which shows that arrears at banks recently, for households, recently rose to levels above that in the early 1990s following the last recession. So a rising arrears, a sign of stress that presents some risk to this scenario.
Actually, I don't think it's true that arrears are higher than the early 1990s. I think where they are is a bit higher than the mid-1990s, which was quite a benign period.
It's where the chart started.
But if you pull apart the arrears data, at least the data I've seen, I think what we have is quite an interesting story. What stands out is that regions of the country that had 2 or 3 years back high rises in prices and rapid growth in lending are the ones where arrears have risen most steeply, and that's southeast Queensland. It's Perth. And going back a little further, it's certain regions of Sydney, dating back from loans made in the mid-2000s. Conversely, at least on the figures I've seen, the arrears performance on 2009 loans is actually better than corresponding than earlier cohorts of loans at the corresponding time since origination. They're the people who've had a bigger rise in interest rate. In fact, most people who borrowed in 2007 or 8 are probably paying less in interest now than they were when they took out the loan. So what's the difference? You know, what's the story there? And I think the story actually is lending standards. Lending standards declined towards the peak of the boom, and they tightened right up after the Lehman event. And that's why the 09 cohort's actually travelling better at this point in time than many of its predecessors did. So I think there's quite a subtle story on the arrears thing. In terms of income dispersion, I don't have the breakdown in front of me. I had the impression that actually the dispersion of income was probably getting wider, skewed more towards the top end, towards the peak of the boom, more than it is at the moment. But, you know, I don't have the most up-to-date figures in front of me to offer any further comment on that. Sorry.
Matthew Johnson, UBS. Governor Stevens, some people will read your speech today and say that the RBA has policy too tight because the cautious consumer means that the boom will not flow through to the broader economy. Others will read the speech and say, well, the RBA has merely been preemptive because the savings rate will soon plateau and the mining boom has much further to go. What do you say?
So there's something for everybody? I'd say the speech is about right in that case.
Thank you, Governor. Joshua Williamson, Citigroup. I also agree with you that productivity is everything, and my question is about that, or I should probably should correctly say the flip side of productivity. Assuming some fairly healthy demand growth, weak productivity growth would imply, other things being equal, that inflation growth could be a little bit of a problem. Now, I would argue also that we won't be seeing the benefits of the infrastructure boom for a few years, given the lead times of some of those investments. Is this something that concerns the Reserve Bank? And if so, is the market missing something with its pricing for 1.5 interest rate cuts over the next 12 or so months?
The analytical point you make is that you know, if we've got a certain notion of appropriate overall wage growth in our mind and the productivity assumption that we've been making isn't correct, then in the medium term we've got an inflation issue that has to be right as a matter of arithmetic. That is a reason to, I think, redouble our focus on productivity. But I think there are many other reasons to do so, foremost among them that this is actually how you make people better off. And if you think about the sectors which are being squeezed by the high exchange rate, and retail or tourism, manufacturing, some parts of it anyway, would be cases in point, you've got product prices under downward pressure, costs under upward pressure. How are you going to square this circle? Well, productivity is really the only answer to that question. So I think it's quite critical. The difficulty is that I don't think there's a, you know, there's no package on the shelf for the government or any policy maker called productivity that you pull down, pump $1 billion into it and away it goes. It doesn't work that way. The productivity comes from the efforts of enterprises and their employees every day doing little things that make things work better. And I think it's hard for policy makers to kind of dictate how that process should work. Our main job is to try to make sure we're not placing any unnecessary impediments there. As for the outlook for inflation, well, we're getting a number tomorrow and we'll be publishing our revised forecasts on Friday week, and I'll leave you in eager anticipation to see what they say, as I am myself in anticipation. Rory?
Rory Robertson, Westpac Treasury. Governor, back in early May, the Reserve Bank was advertising a strong tightening bias. More recently, that seems to have been put to one side like an abandoned baby. You've explained today that far from being disturbed by the cautious consumer, the Reserve Bank welcomes the cautious consumer. And yet outside the Reserve Bank, there seems to be a growing view that policy might be too tight. My question is, what sorts of things would you need to see to start thinking that policy is too tight? And are you starting to see those things?
I'm not going to comment on the policy outlook, Rory. Let me go back to the comment you made that we welcome the cautious consumer. Well, I think, you know, it's not a matter of welcoming it or fearing it. It's there. The point of today is to try to understand why it's there and what it means, and hopefully that will inform our judgments into the future. In the end, the task of monetary policy is to promote as much as we can sustainable growth and an inflation rate starting with a 2 on average. That's what we're continuing to do, and we will continue that. There's one more.
Good afternoon, Governor. Stan Rickett, private consultant. Mine's a pretty straightforward question after the previous ones. In your view, with the household behaviour conservatism and the saving ratio, what part of that is being driven by the baby boomers, the pre-retirees or those in early retirement who have suddenly cut back on their consumption, and also that are looking at increasing their saving ratio in their DIY super and other forms? Mm.
It's a good question, in the written version of the talk, I note in a footnote that I haven't come at demographics, not because I don't think it's important, but there was enough to try to explain here today. I think the phenomenon that you allude to may well be an important part of the story. It may well be that part of the run-up in debt and leverage and so on was also in that group. I don't have the figures before me really to prove that one way or the other, but I think as our understanding of this continues to develop, I'm sure that we're going to go investigate that particular phenomenon, because I suspect it is part of the story.
Thank you, Governor.